All right, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It's great to have you all on board. Stay with us. Wellness Wednesday coming up just around the corner, but I want to pass on your kind comments towards Jessica. Vote done. Good luck. That's what we want to hear. Tell me how to vote. She's fabulous. You go to tgcahar/... Can't remember, actually, already. It's gone. Junior Eurovision. On Facebook, Grania Hines, amazing, a star. Rosie, an amazing singer. She'll do us proud. Dolores, well done, Jessica. You're a little star. Mary, absolutely beautiful voice. Right, ladies and gentlemen, go on to TG Carr's website and vote for Jessica, because as I say, she's younger than the other contestants and it's a straight public vote. So she's not going to be able to campaign as much as the others. And if you want Donegal to represent Ireland in Nice in November, well, that's the way to do it. Wellness Wednesday. Our guest today is Paula Leonard, CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland. And it's great to have you back on the show, Paula. How are you keeping?
I'm good. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good. Right. Okay. We're talking about the first ever report on the experiences and challenges for families raising a child with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which was recently launched. But we'll start with a bit of an understanding as to what it is. So what is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and how does it affect a person?
It's a really good question, actually, because there's very little awareness in the population around what fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are. So fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are the largest cause of intellectual disability that's preventable at a global level. So in Ireland, we have estimated to have the third highest rate of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in the world. And in very simple terms, I suppose, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are caused by exposure of the fetus to alcohol while in the womb during pregnancy, because alcohol passes very freely through the placenta. It's very similar to water, and it has quite significant impacts on brain development. So what you have with FASDs are a range of neurological disorders in children, and you have a lot of comorbidities. So for example, ADHD, ADD, autism spectrum disorders. But when you looked at the autism one in this particular report, 21% of parents said that, you know, the child for whom they're caring also had a diagnosis for ASD, and 21% is much higher than you would expect, mm-hmm. and much higher than it is in other research in other countries around.
And neither of us are suggesting for a moment that anyone diagnosed with what you've discussed there, the likes of autism and what have you, it's because the mother drank. We're just saying there can be an increased prevalence of it if the fetus is exposed to alcohol. Is it possible then that much of the FASD cases go undiagnosed? You know, in other words, we identify a comorbidity but don't necessarily identify its cause, or do we have a handle on that?
No, that's absolutely it, Greg. And I mean, we are a country that has no diagnostic capacity for diagnosing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder in children. So children may have a partial diagnosis. You're absolutely right. These conditions may occur together. They may have a partial diagnosis for part of what is the issue presenting in that child, but they may not have a full diagnosis. And back as early as 2018, Alcohol Forum Ireland would have presented before an Oireachtas Health Committee calling on government to look at the issue of diagnostic services. But I suppose, you know, what we're now looking at with this report is the lived experiences of families raising children with FASD in this country. They're not seen. They're not heard.
Well, there's very little we don't have educational campaigns, financings and supports if we don't have a idea of the problem or the situation. So one really often follows the other. Is there a reluctance from parents because, you know, maybe someone wasn't aware of the damage drinking alcohol might do to an unborn child, but they did drink the alcohol? Then obviously, do they feel responsible? Are they less likely to come through? Does that mask the extent of the problem? Do you understand where I'm coming from? I'm trying to be really sensitive
absolutely.
With my language.
Look, but you know, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is probably one of the most stigmatized of all health issues. But the fact that it's that stigmatized isn't a reason for us not to talk about it, and isn't a reason for, you know, the Department of Children not to provide specialised services, and for the Department of Health not to look at this issue in terms of what we need for diagnostics. I think it's a really important question, though, too, because if people don't know, there cannot be a blame. There isn't a blame here with this. So until we have population level awareness that alcohol is a teratogen, which is, you know, a fancy scientific word for something that's toxic during pregnancy. So, you know, we have other teratogens that, you know, we have a population level awareness about and things that people know. You know, for example, the thalidomide scandal in this country, we were very aware and are aware now that thalidomide mm-hmm. is a teratogen and that it has that impact during pregnancy. So therefore it's banned.
Yeah.
We are moving forward slightly. And I suppose the Irish government has announced that we'll introduce health warning labels on alcoholic products in 2026. And that will bring us closer to people having a right to know and a right to understand the risks associated with consuming alcohol.
But I think even that is not, if I'm not mistaken, is being challenged on a European level in due to competition laws and what have you. But anyway, hopefully they can
see
that through.
And I mean, you know, if we're going to talk about blame, I think that's where we start. We talk about why people don't know that this is the risk. So when Ireland announced that in 2026 it's going to go ahead with its alcohol labelling and that it was going to go ahead with the pregnancy warning, 7 countries across the EU launched objections. Now, the ministry, the EU has given Ireland the green light to go ahead with this. Mm-hmm. And in a positive sense, what we're now seeing is countries across Europe and across the globe looking to Ireland and saying, mm-hmm. right, well, how did you get this one over the line in face of significant opposition from a very powerful, very big mm-hmm. Alcohol industry? And that's what we're up against. And I think that will go some measure to giving people the information that they need to know about this. But I mean, our approach absolutely towards fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is that there's no shame and that there's no blame. And mm-hmm. where we need to get to is a place where people know the risks and that they're supported. But this report in particular, Greg, not to harp on about it, is not just about the prevention piece. This report is saying we need supports for the families yeah. who are raising
and we'll get to that, but we also yeah. I also want to give people the best opportunity to avoid this. And, you know, I've sat in this chair and talked about pretty much everything, lots of stuff to do with pregnancy, post-pregnancy, before pregnancy, fertility, everything. I can't recall off the top of my head maybe once, you know, the HSE looking to come on to discuss drinking when pregnant. But I have heard out and about a glass of wine's okay. You know, it, one or two is fine. You know, it'll relax you and it's better for you if you're relaxed, it's better for the babe. Different stuff that you hear over the course of your life, if you know what I mean. But I don't recall hearing an organised campaign that's done in a non-judgmental, non-blaming way, informing people of the dangers of drinking alcohol, women, when pregnant. And I really think, you know, at the very least, the public deserve the best opportunity to avoid it by being given that information by the executive that's charged with doing so.
Yeah, look, I think that the medical community hasn't been clear enough about this historically. Okay. You know, we've had messages that have gone to pregnant women through their family groups, from their GPs, from hospital services. You know, historically, women in Ireland would have been told that a glass of Guinness towards the end of your pregnancy would help to keep your iron levels up. So those are messages that cause confusion and they get passed down. I have to say, though, that the HSE did launch last year a 12-point prevention plan around fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
Fair.
If you go to their website, you know, the HSE Ask About Alcohol campaign, and you search pregnancy, you will get very clear and unequivocal scientific evidence that says there is no known safe level of alcohol during pregnancy. So we know that the development of FASDs is to do with the stage in your pregnancy that you consume alcohol, but it's also to do with the amount of alcohol consumed. Those things said, there's no safe level that we know of from a purely scientific point of view. And people need to hear that and be supported to understand that
yep.
and be supported to have alcohol-free pregnancies.
Yeah, but our starting point, though, is we have the highest prevalence of alcohol consumption during pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I have to be very clear that that's a guesstimate. So that's based on women's self-reported drinking during pregnancy. We don't have diagnostics, so we don't know, do you know what I mean, what the actual level of FASD in this country is. But it's estimated that 5% of children born in this country. So 5% of our children and our young people in this country could be somewhere on the fetal alcohol spectrum.
Yeah. So in terms of supports, we have to get diagnostics right before we can implement supports, I presume. What did you want to say on that, Paula?
You could get into a chicken and egg argument, and I think diagnostics are really important, but I don't think that we can ignore what's happening with families right now. And I think there are supports that could get put in place. There could be funding for parent support groups. So we have, you know, the NPAE group that's based here in Donegal, but has reach across Ireland. And they are a parent support group that don't receive any funding from the state. We have FASD Ireland, a newer group that's also a parent support group. So we're seeing emerging mm-hmm. a need for those kind of supports. There are also things that people can do. There are strategies for supporting children in school settings. There are strategies for supporting, you know, social workers who may be coming across children. There are ways.
Just to help me understand, okay. So obviously, what can also happen as a result of FESD is the likes of autism spectrum disorder, as you mentioned, attention deficit disorder, right? Which are, if you can get the diagnosis, you can get them identified, and then the schools hopefully will be able to adapt. Okay. So what extra layer comes from an FASD diagnosis? If, and as I say, pardon my ignorance, if you know what I mean, but what if an FASD diagnosis was there, what are the appropriate supports outside of what supports might be given for, say, autism or ADHD?
Yeah, I suppose they, you know, pointing across the water where they are progressing on this, and they've done a prevalence study in the UK. The University of Salford is actually looking at what exactly do parenting strategies look like and parenting supports look like for people raising children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Because what we know is that your generic whole population sort of parenting programs aren't really appropriate and don't really hit the mark for children with FASD or people parenting children with FASD. So there are those types of parenting supports, parenting group supports, funding that could be put in place even before we have diagnostic capacity. I also think that training for, you know, the education sector in particular and for the social work sector would be really, really useful place to start, at least that they had a competency in understanding what they might be looking at, what needs children may have in school and what supports that they might need to, you know, reach their full potential. Because children with FASD have exactly the same right to early intervention and support as every other child in this country. But we're not seeing that and hearing that at the moment.
Yeah. And just to reiterate, a solid evaluation, it's a guesstimate, I suppose, of 5% of young people in Ireland may have the effects of FASD. I suppose in the first instance, there's no safe level of alcohol consumption during pregnancy. It's tough, and it's women have to bear that, of course, as usual. But that is the way it is. And then, of course, we have to support those. We have to support those affected by this as well. Useful for public consumption, this report, Paula, or is it a bit technical, or what's the story, or where can we access it?
It's an academic report, absolutely, but there is a nice executive summary at the beginning, okay. You know, that summarises what's in it, and the call to action, the clear recommendations, you know, at the back of the report are supports for families, supports for children, and diagnostic capacity in this country. And I think, you know, back in 2015, there was a study published in the Irish Medical Journal where I think just over 30% of paediatricians working in this country had said they had no awareness that FASDs existed.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we have a long way to go in this country, but none of that is an excuse for not starting on the journey. And, you know, it's really useful even to be having conversations on radio about this, to be having conversations, you know, in women's groups and organisations, in health organisations, wherever we can, we need to start talking about this.
And it's not to be judgmental or anything, and you never in that space, and I hope I'm not, but, you know, people have to have information to make informed decisions. You know, we have to make sure, and hopefully through the course of this conversation, I know our words, your words, not mine, I'm interviewing you, have reached someone today. Do you know what I mean? We know that. That's the way it works, because they've got, right, I didn't realise my auntie told me, or what, you know what I mean, but this,
is about trusting women and trusting women to make the best decisions for themselves and for their babies. And what we know in this country in particular is that we have a really high sort of level of adherence. You know, when women are advised that folic acid is good for pregnancy, they take it. When women are told that they need to have increased iron in their diet during pregnancy, they do it. So we know that women can be trusted. What we haven't got is we haven't got enough clear, timely and factual information for women. And I think that's, you know, this is just another tool in the toolkit around that.
100%. Thank you so much, as always, Paula. Paula Leonard there, who is CEO of Alcohol Form Ireland. Hi, Greg. The newly released draft Donegal County Council Development Plan includes increasing the population of the county by 20,000 by 2040. This can only be achieved by mass immigration, and it's inevitable that native Irish will be in a minority in their own country. Well, the native Irish, if they're so, they need to start speaking Irish, because it's going to be the third most popular language, if it's not already. Will we stop referring to the Great Replacement Theory as a theory? If a country wants to grow, you need people to do it. People here aren't having babies. We heard someone reference contraception a little earlier on. You know, if you want your hospitals and if you want all your services and you want this, that and that, you need people to provide those services as well. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000, and emails to comments@highlandradio.com. Okay, let us now say good morning to Rosina McLaughlin, who's chair of the Buncrana Leisure Centre Committee. Good morning to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you on the programme. Right, so where are we at in terms of the provision of a leisure centre for Buncrana? It's an amazing gap in services in Inishowen for a number of reasons, not least even just young people learning to swim in a coastal community. But what is the story?
Yeah, it's been very badly missed, Greg. But thankfully, we have some positive news this week, and the committee is absolutely delighted. We've worked tirelessly to try and bring this project along. And yesterday the planning permission appeared in the paper, so it's great news.
And what does this mean? Because I heard calls for this to be tied into the overall development of Buncrana, coupled in with that. Are you familiar with those calls, and is that something that you would welcome?
Yes, absolutely. Our problem is that the initial funding grant from the Swimming Pools Fund, which we got in 2005, it's $3.2 million. Now, that was only to refurbish the pool, but we decided that it was so far gone that the sensible thing was to build a new state-of-the-art centre, and we need matching funding for that. So we're hoping that we can be tied in with the Empowering Buncrana project and get to, we'd probably need about $8 million. So that'll be down to the councillors to approve the project and to go ahead and provide the funding within the next 12 months. We hope we'll get approval for that.
Yeah, and the longer this takes, the way things work, the more expensive the project gets. So we need to get a move on, because the estimated cost of building this has gone up and up and up while we've been chatting, Rosina.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Inflation hasn't been kind to us. So at the minute, we're looking at approximately $11 million spend on the shorefront, which would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. And you see these projects working well together then, obviously?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely, yeah.
All right, okay. So what if you could, in your best estimates, timeline this. So the planning is in now, right? So hopefully that we go through all of those hoops. I think the council have committed to at least part funding it, if not match funding this, and it's finding the other resources from elsewhere and getting this project over the line. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it'll be down to the members at the January meeting. Obviously, the county council can't apply to themselves for planning permission. It's down to all the members at the January meeting to approve the planning permission. Then the tender document, well, the councillor in the process of drawing up the tender documents at the minute. They will go out to tender. That takes a while. Tenders come back. People get a chance, their builders get a chance to object. Finally, there's a builder appointed. Unfortunately, with the time scale, I'd say we're looking at this time next year to get a builder appointed.
Yeah, okay.
But look, it's good news. We have to be positive.
For sure.
It's been a long time coming. And it's coming now.
Hopefully, because you know yourself, Rosina, far more than I would, Folstones. You know, we've had stories of in 2019, 2018, 2020, council rings, ring fences, funding. You know, we're all ready to dive into the development of Buncrana Leisure Centre. That was in 2018 or 2019. You know yourself. So hopefully now we are really on the precipice of this becoming a reality, because it's much, much needed for not just the local area, but I think the peninsula as a whole.
The whole peninsula, the vast hinterland of the catchment area of people who haven't been able to teach their children to swim or go swimming themselves for fitness for a long, long time now.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in the past we've had disappointments, and nobody knows that more than me and the voluntary committee. But look, there's no point in looking back. We're looking ahead now. We're going to have a leisure centre in the next, hopefully, 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah, and that's been a thankless task at times as well too. So fair play to you and others for sticking with it. And hopefully, as I say, we're about to springboard into a positive bit of news. Thanks, Rosina.
Well, I would just ask, the public who need this so badly, want it so badly, get on to your local representatives, push now to get it ahead, get the money, and let's get building the state-of-the-art centre.
All right, Rosina, thank you very much indeed. And in fairness to the local representatives in Buncrana and elsewhere too in the local municipal districts, they do work well together on issues like this. A caller says, in relation to our last conversation with Paula, I've been fostering for 35 years and I've been very well aware of the issue, but no one wanted to hear it. Britain have been creating awareness of it for years. Ireland has been slow on this issue. Many children have been misdiagnosed because of this issue. It's not all about women. Men overdrinking has also caused many issues via the sperm. Okay, which I wasn't sure. Well, I didn't realise that that could contribute to it. Where is Piers Doherty getting all the money to pay for all of this? Is it the credit union in Gwydor? Don't think so. No, any budget has to be costed, if you know what I mean. You can't, when the government's preparing its budget or when the opposition is preparing its alternative budget, and it's not just Sinn Féin, other parties will as well, it has to be costed. With all the money being allocated to climate change, what percentage of the atmosphere is CO2? I can't answer that one. Ask Pierce, should Irish people be entitled to housing before other nationalities? Hi, Greg, could you please ask Pierce why carers cannot get fuel allowance? We'll ask that separately and chase that up. Can you ask Pierce where does Sinn Féin stand regarding industrial wind turbines on peat bogs in Donegal? Does Sinn Féin support more turbines on peat bogs? I'm sure I've asked either he or his party colleague that before. But look, at as we approach an election, things we're going to start getting into far more scrutiny of policies and plans and what have you. So those questions will not go unanswered, or at least unasked. So don't you worry about that, because there's going to come a point in the not too distant future where you're going to have to make a decision what kind of government you want next. Do you want the current government to remain, or do you want to give someone else a go? But you're going to want specific questions answered, and we're going to facilitate all of that here on the 9 till noon show and across Highland Radio. Good morning, Greg. Carrying on from texts you read out there, I was struck by the age of the new Ukrainian army on recent mainstream TV. They're literally children now. They are being thrown into the meat grinder proxy war. Where is this going to end? Will the Irish army also be sent to their doom on the front line? That's not going to happen. But look, a lot of people don't talk about the conscription of young Ukrainian, primarily men, forced to go to war. I mean, it's scary, isn't it? And you know, there's no doubt about it. The West, the United States, Europe, and we're part of that, are fighting Russia through Ukraine on Ukrainian land with Western weapons. When will it end? I don't know. I just wish it would, because anyone with children, and you don't even have to have children, the idea that your 18-year-old could be ripped from the house, either in Ukraine and Russia, a gun shoved into their hands, and them sent to their death, it's unimaginable. But that's the lived experience. of what's happening. All right, it is Wednesday, so that means we're going to have a bit of business. Kieran O'Donnell is going to be with us shortly. Stay where you are.
Business Matters, in association with the ATU Donegal Faculty of Business. If you're a parent or guardian of a first-year student in the area of business, law, design, tourism or sport, join ATU's online information evening on Wednesday, the 11th of October at 7 p.m. Call 918-6207 or email facultyofbusinessadmin.donegal@atu.ie.
Okie dokie, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show, and we go straight into Business Matters, the Highland Radio podcast. It's broadcast on Sundays. We'll tell you more about that later on, but it's available for you right now to listen at on demand on our website. Presenter Kieran O'Donnell joins us in studio now. Kieran, great to have you on board.
Good morning.
I had this camera set up for Jessica. Right. Who's 10 years old, and you're about 10 years off 70.
Slightly older.
Okay, we have you there now. Right, we'll get to the show in a bit, but fair play to the council, a nice national award for them.
Yes, we've talked about this a few times before, Greg. Donegal County Council project has been awarded at the 2023 Irish Planning Institute Awards. So it's the Ballyshannon Historic Towns Initiative Project, and it was selected as the winner of the Urban Regeneration and Heritage category. The award ceremony took place last Thursday at Clontarf Castle, and the award-winning project involved a large-scale urban regeneration, and it focused on existing individual historic buildings in Ballyshannon Town Centre to reverse the effects and neglect and advance in decay. So I was just thinking about coming up, Greg. These are projects we need to see more of, more often, and many more other towns and villages across the country, because, look, this programme is well familiar with, I suppose, the shortage of accommodation. That's so, the one drawback that I had, there doesn't seem to be enough of these happening, and there's a very limited number of them being rolled out. So I just wonder why that reason, you know?
Yeah, for sure, defo. Now, house prices on the rise in Donegal anyway.
Yeah, average price in Donegal has risen to €170,000, and that is according to the latest report by myhome.ie. The figures show that there's been an increase of 11.8% in the price of a three-bedroom house in Donegal over the third quarter of this year. And just as a side note to that, the average house inflation is now running at just over 4%.
Pardon my ignorance, but are there many houses out there for, you know, a decent three-bedroom house for $170,000? Like, so if that's the average, there's obviously going to be houses worth $250,000, $350,000. So that means there has to be houses out there for $110,000, $120,000, $130,000, $140,000. I mean, not that there's a great deal of activity in the housing market here, but I always look at that and I wonder, well, you know, if houses are available for that price, where are they?
My other sort of train of thought has turned to sort of new builds. And I was out for a run there last Thursday up around Glencaw. And it was like something out of the blue to see a house being under construction. There's such a rare state around the minute.
But if you drive through the north, say you're going to Dublin or something, you see housing estates, you know, residential. I just wonder where these houses are at that value. But anyway, that's what the official stats tell us. Talent Hub has been launched. What's this about?
I think we've jumped over scripts here.
Well, listen. Well, do you want to go into the West Chamber?
Yeah, we'll go with that one.
All right, then. I don't use the script. This is all off the top of my head.
The next Dedicated Chamber into the West event will take place on Thursday, October the 12th at the TCS campus in Letterkenny. This event, Greg, will discuss sustainability for business, green skills for success, and the guest speakers will include Donald Kearney from Pragmatica, Head of Enterprise with Leo Donegal, Brenda Higgerty, and Barry Harper, who is the Managing Director of Involve. The panel discussion will be moderated by Annette Houston, who is MD of FM Services Group, and the event is being sponsored by Tech Northwest Skillnet. To book a place, email marie@letterkennychamber.com.
I'm surprised at this. A big drop in tourist attraction visits.
Come on, the story like when I say over
big,
the weekend, Greg.
This is big.
When you talk about the scale, it's huge. Visits to tourist attractions in Ireland were at just 58% of pre-COVID levels in 2022, and that is according to new research by the Association of Visitor Experiences and Attractions. A survey by the industry body found that 13.3 million people visited an attraction and aired it last year, and that was up substantially on the 4.3 million in 2021 when COVID-19 restrictions were still in place, but down 22.9 million in 2019. That's a lot of people and a lot of visitors, Greg, when you see it written down for... We're a small country.
Yeah.
The greatest challenges were faced by those outside Dublin, which is understandable, according to the research, with transport costs, not surprisingly, being the biggest
are
issue.
Are we talking the Slieve Lees, the Greenia Valleys? When we talk about tourism attractions, or are we talking, you know, Tato Park, or whatever it's called now, Emerald Park?
It's hard to know.
Yeah. But that's a big, big, big drop. Okay, I just randomly want you to talk about something else now.
Yeah.
If you can stop reading your messages for 2 minutes.
I thought it might have been something in relation to, I think I had to get asked to give a mention to you, but we're on schedule. Time to strengthen the regional impact of Greater North West is the theme of a conference taking place in the University of Ulster's Derry campus tomorrow. The conference, which is free, will examine the socio-economic infrastructure and investment policies that are needed to address the regional inequalities and imbalance in the Northwest. The event runs from 10 to 4 and it's free, and booking is through Eventbrite.
Now, people listening or watching, for that matter, might find this hard to believe, but we actually don't rehearse this.
Oh, no, whatever, well. I'm just hoping that you'll not go in too much of a tangent.
This is all done off the top of our heads.
I prepared and you get it when I walk in. Sometimes you look at it, sometimes you don't.
I'm a bit more confident about your guests coming up on this week's podcast, Kieran. Who do you have?
Yeah, Greg, my guests this week are the founder of Glenard Plant in Letterkenny, James Russell, and his son Eamon and daughter Denise McTague, who took over the running of the business based at Tara Court in 2016. James set up Glenard with the help and support of his wife Anne, and the business currently employs 21 people. During our conversation, I asked James what was the biggest challenge he had encountered in his business life.
Trying to make bank institutions that make them believe that you're serious and that, you know, you're definitely worth a bit, like, style of thing. But most of the time, you're on your own. You just had to try and build your own trust with the clientele you're dealing with. And, you know, there are times you just had to leave banks behind you. And, you know, I bought machines and bought them and hadn't the money to buy them. The trust was put in you, and thank God that trust carried me right through my whole career to where I am today.
Denise's studies took her to the catering route, and she came extremely close, Greg, to pursuing a career in the catering sector. I asked Denise why she opted instead to work full-time in the family business.
Well, I was very, very close to pursuing that further. Just, I enjoyed it. I liked it. I liked working in that industry. But I would say too, maybe at the time when I saw that Mum and Dad was needing somebody, I just thought, I think I would like to try and help Mum and Dad. And I think, and again, yes, you were studying differently and you were doing different things, but you saw the dedication that was needed from home from Mum and Dad. And I thought, no, just a wee bit of help would, you know, and probably in the initial outset, it would have been just a wee bit of help from Mum and Dad, but... The help went on and on and on and on, and I'm still here today.
Eamon Russell has always been involved in the family business, and here he recalls a decision by himself and Denise to invest in a drain camera unit when they took over the running of the business.
In 2016, one of the first investments me and Denise done when we took over was we went straight and bought a drain camera unit for surveying the drains onto the ground. And that was the first investment the two of us had there. So basically how it operates, if there's a problem on a pipe underneath the ground, basically you stick this camera down, it goes down, shows you the full inside of the pipe and gives you basically a true reading of the condition of it. Some people doesn't like to see you come in with a report after, but what can you do? It's there in black and white for them. And if there's a problem, then you can locate exactly on the ground where the problem is if you need to dig it up or anything like that.
So how big a part is the draining area of your business now?
It'll be very much 50-50 between sweeping and drain cleaning. Maybe the drain cleaning at times could be a lot bigger. You know, we've actually, in the recent years as well, we've actually moved into underground pipe repair, where you don't have to actually dig the pipes up, you can repair them underneath the ground.
All right, Eamon, they're interesting to get the various members of the families and their perspectives.
Just in the off air, it's the first time I suppose I interviewed three people together from the same business and from the same family. The hard work, Greg, I suppose, it's always the one recurring line you get. James works hard, and even though he's sort of taken a step back, he's still very much involved. Officially, Eamon and Denise took over the running of the business in 2016. It has evolved and developed from road cleaning to drain cleaning, pipe repair, winter maintenance, snow plough, and a grilling of car parks. So 21 people is a sizable workforce for a business like that. And they have a great passion for what they do. They get on very well. They keep it simple. And they were very welcoming, and I really enjoyed the chat with them.
Brilliant. The full interviews with James, Denise and Eamon are available to download right now. We'll stream on our website, highlandradio.com. We're on Spotify or iTunes, and on air later too, Kieran.
Yeah, Business Matters goes out on air on Sunday evening, Greg, after the 6 o'clock news.
And if anyone wants to get in touch with you?
Yeah, just drop me an email, please. businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
All right, Kieran, listen, thanks as always for all of your effort, and we look forward to chatting to you next Wednesday.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you.
Take care of yourself. If you want to have a chat to us, 086 60 25000 or call us on 074 91 25000. Now, Larry Donnelly is law lecturer at University of Galway, political columnist also with journal.ie, and he joins us on the programme now for quite interesting historic news emerging out of the United States as US House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has been removed from office. This after a challenge, which as I say is historic, to his leadership from elements within his own party. Larry, good morning to you. Thanks so much for your time as always.
Great to be with you, Greg.
So, Kevin McCarthy, I mean, I presume this was his political dream. He hasn't held on to the post very long, and he'll go down in history as the first ever to be removed from his office. What led to this, Larry?
Well, I think it started from the get-go. If you look at Kevin McCarthy when he became Speaker, it took 15 votes for him to get elected, and that was because really, the Republican majority in the House was a lot smaller than people had anticipated it would be last time. And because in order to win, McCarthy had to make lots of concessions to the very hard right of his party. There's some 20 or 30 people who are extremists who don't really care about the future of the Republican Party, who care about themselves and their own principles, as they may be. So one of the concessions he had to make was that just one member could take a motion to vacate the chair. Just one member could start a move to oust him as Speaker. So having accepted all those concessions, a lot of people would have said he was on borrowed time already. And indeed, the events of recent events where he cut a deal with Democrats to keep the government afloat, that was just too much for this band of extremists. And that's why we are where we are.
Yeah, and that does create its own issues, because there'll have to be another vote on another package to keep government in situ. That's only, I think, 5, 6, 7 weeks away. So the role of a speaker and how he's cutting deals to get things passed, I know it's probably quite complex and convoluted, but ours is more of a chairmanship role, in our equivalent. So that role is incredibly important, is it? And what power does it hold?
Yeah, I mean, it's not ceremonial at all. I mean, the Speaker is the de facto leader of the United States Congress. He or she is number three in line in authority in the United States behind the president and the vice president, and takes a huge role directly and indirectly in shaping the party's legislative agenda and what happens in the House. So it is a vitally important role. And there is now a caretaker Speaker who's been appointed in the wake of McCarthy's ouster. Patrick McHenry is his name. But his job really is to get a new Speaker elected to the post. He's really kind of powerless. And as you say, with the government shutdown, again, coming up or coming to the fore on the 17th of November, things need to move pretty quickly to get someone new in situ. And again, that could be a complicated process as well.
The United States continues to go ever deeper into debt. It's not far off potentially being unsustainable. There's issues too with migrants flooding the country. There's concerns too about the money being spent to fight a war in Ukraine. Can an agreement be reached with everything that's happening politically and all the concerns? Will it be easy to reach an agreement to sustain the government going forward?
The short answer is no. I mean, the three things that you've said are what I suppose really animate the hard right of the Republican Party: the spending, the border, and funding Ukraine, which they want to see an end to. So those are three of their big priorities. Now, the issue in the immediate term is going to be, who can Republicans rally around to become the next Speaker of the House? There are some names in the ether. Steve Scalise, who's currently the majority leader, he would be the heir apparent, but he's been receiving cancer treatment, so his health is an issue. The other point in this, Greg, is that one of the reasons why I thought McCarthy would hang on, and why I'm surprised by all of this, is I never foresaw the entire Democratic Party voting along side Matt Gaetz, of all people, an extremist Republican with a very, very checkered past. I never imagined they would vote with him to remove McCarthy. They did so because they evidently totally distrust and dislike him. But that having been said, the reality is that McCarthy is somebody who's lost his job because he did a deal with them to keep the government afloat. Now, I just wonder about this because if, as you say, is entirely possible, Republicans get a new speaker, and this is somebody who's entirely unwilling to do any kind of deal in the government that then shuts down, could Democrats be held accountable by the people just as Republicans will be? Could it be a bipartisan plague on all your houses if the government shuts down? That's a risk the Democrats have taken.
And just in relation to the relationship between the U.S. speaker and the sitting president, and what role or influence he might have in that regard. What is that? Because, as I say, there's a very short line of command between the two. Does the president have much influence in that regard? Does he try and exercise that influence? And what's the benefit to him?
I'm not sure what the president might have been doing behind the scenes. Once this all broke, the president very publicly, repeatedly stated, this is a matter for everyone up on Capitol Hill. I'm going to stay out of this. I don't think President Biden was any fan of Kevin McCarthy, but I do think, having been around as long as he has, I do think he recognized the fact that the alternative could be worse. And this is the cautionary note I would sound, is that Democrats should be careful what they have wished for. They might get something a whole lot worse here. Now, of course, there are all sorts of reasons why they voted against, why they voted to remove McCarthy. But this is a complicated scenario. So it could be the situation where the next speaker and the president have a much more frosty relationship than the admittedly distant one that McCarthy and Biden had.
Yeah, okay. It's always fascinating, and often for the wrong reasons, U.S. politics. You're not going to be short of anything to write about in the journal or talk to your students about. Anyway, that's for sure, Larry.
That's for sure. No, as I say, it is, I mean, all joking aside, it is quite a sad state of affairs. We can only hope it gets better.
Yeah, and it's hard to see how. And then what actually we're seeing is some of the problems being replicated in other countries. It's almost gone global. Okay, Larry, great to have you on the show as always. Larry Donnelly there, law lecturer at University of Galway, political columnist with the journal.ie. That story leading the Nationals today, such is its perceived significance. Okay, 086 60 25,000, 0749 125,000. The government, says this listener, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, are out of touch. I must say that whatever your political views are, one has to admire Pierce Doherty's drive, vision and enthusiasm. But again, for a lot of people out there today and heading up to election time, it's going to be about the words and the delivery. Brilliant. It's going to be like, will it make a difference to me? Will we see a difference? Will the problems that I face on a day-to-day basis be eased somewhat? That remains to be seen. According to Sinn Féin, it'll cost us $700 billion to get to net zero. Where does Pierce think we as a country will get this money? Well, it's not Sinn Féin that is saying that. It's the it's one of the think tanks. Is it the RSI? They're saying for us to get to net zero through lost taxes and spending and subsidy of farming and fines to Europe and all that kind of stuff, that to get to net zero by 2050, it'll cost $700 billion. But there's also big bills to be paid by 2035 as well, because a lot of the revenue and the income that to get to where they want to get to with net zero, and we don't really have much choice in it because we're part of Europe and we've signed up to it. And in fact, what we're seeing in Europe is some of the targets being tightened rather than loosened. So we any government, unless they renege on their commitments in Europe, which is not that easy to do either, will have to do this. But if you think the lost revenue in terms of taxation on fuel, for example, but the increased spend then, because obviously as the pressure comes on farmers, and let's make no mistake about it, 23 agriculture is seen as the big issue. So whilst we've been talking about nitrates directives and all that kind of stuff, and that'll get us through this year and maybe next year, it's coming down the line. The pressure will be on to effectively cut farming, unless we can find some magical way to do it that can meet the new targets that, as I say, are inevitable. So farmers are going to have to be compensated, plus the impact less farming might have on rural life, rural communities. All of that, more electric cars, more power, all it's got to cost $700 billion. I wouldn't like to figure it out, and I'm not sure anyone has a handle really on how that might be done. I want to mention to you, because I haven't for a while, that we are going to a divine musical comedy, Sister Act. It is eagerly anticipated. Lots of people want to see this, and we're going to make it really simple for you if you do want to see it, because we're going to take a busload of you down to the musical Sister Act in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin. It's going to be an unforgettable show, and it's on Friday the 23rd of February, which in a way seems like a long time, but also it is just around the corner. So the trip with us includes luxury transfers, beautiful buses to take you down there. You get bed and breakfast at the four-star City North Hotel in Dublin, and you get a really good ticket for the show as well. And there's an opportunity the next morning to go out and do a bit of shopping if you want to in and around Dublin before we get you back onto that luxury transport and back up the road. So for more information, I don't have the price of it here. For more information on it, give us a call. You can book your ticket 074-91-25000, or more commonly known as 074-91-25000, or visit highlandradio.com. All the information is there. And as I say, if you're one of the people out there who might be struggling for a Christmas present, this is perfect. You can get it bought now or get a deposit down now. It's a great Christmas present, and it's not too long after Christmas that you can look forward to it and book to go yourself. It's a Christmas present for yourself as well. So go on to our website, highlandradio.com, which is a great resource for you, and we probably don't talk enough about this. We have millions upon millions of you that go to the website every single month. We've got details too on the Highland Radio Hooli. It's to Sulu in September of next year. All the details on that are there. You get the very latest breaking news. You get Highland Radio On Demand podcasts and all that. So go and visit the website, bookmark it if you haven't before, highlandradio.com. That's where we have to leave it on the show today. Thanks to Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the programme, as always. We're back with you tomorrow morning at 9.